And I'm going to start the bidding here at £5 million. £5 million, £5 million, £6 million now. £6 million, £6 million,
£7 million now. £7 million. We're down and out. We're down and out. In the art world. Hey, hi all. Thanks for coming and welcome to another edition of Down and Out in the Art World. I'm here with Bobby Dowler, my regular co-host, and we're basically talking about art school and uni. Is it worth it? So Down and Out in the Art World is effectively a show about being poor in the art world, being working class, being, how can I say, amongst the marginalised. I guess me and Bobby, I don't know if we describe ourselves as actually marginalised. We did go into this before, but, you know, we're not middle class, put it that way. So we've kind of come through the system to some extent. I'm a writer, theorist, critic, and sometimes curator, and Bobby is a painter and has worked in many other roles in the art world. And we're basically just sharing our knowledge, our anecdotes, and giving advice where we can. And I think one of the things that's really important is just that we speak out at all, because a lot of people don't feel comfortable to express perhaps their kind of relative underprivileged economic position in the art world and how that can be a problem. And I think that makes it harder if you can't express it. So hopefully by sharing our knowledge, we can get other people to feel okay about being maybe down and out, so to speak, in the art world. So today we're talking about art school and uni. So for many people, art school basically is where it all starts. It's where the dream of being an outsider, freely expressing themselves begins. So one kind of gets a feeling in their late teens, you know, that they want to be, shall we say, free, using the most naive terms, because you are naive at that age. And you go to art school to freely express yourself. You're thinking about Van Gogh, you're thinking about Edvard Munch, you're thinking about, I don't know what, but you're thinking about, you know, basically somehow refusing the system, some romantic notion of the artist that rebels. And then you end up sorely delusioned. You end up basically with those kind of dreams being dashed and having them replaced with a lot of kind of career climbing goals involving money and galleries and things. I mean, maybe it's a bit different if someone's ending up at uni now at 18, 19, because of the tuition fees involved, etc. They may be weighing up the options in terms of employability and making money, and maybe they're more expecting some kind of vocational training, some training on how to deal with the real world of gallerists and art sales, etc. But I'd still wager that part of the university experience is about knocking the kind of dream-like status of art practice out of the student. So certainly when I did it, you know, your first, second year is kind of about people being told to leave alone Van Gogh, to leave alone Salvador Dali. And, you know, you kind of get introduced to another reality of curators and gallerists and things. For social science students, lit, psychology, politics students, it's pretty much the same. So your dreams go up in smoke as realpolitik kind of squeezes out your best intentions. So you kind of get introduced to the real world. So you have CV writing classes, you know, as much as you're going to get classes on romantic poetry. So this kind of carries on into postgrad, and then into even becoming a lecturer or professor. So I think it carries on into PhD level even. I recall thinking that PhD fellow students and some professors were incredibly career driven, and I was doing a PhD in philosophy. I kind of expected that to be, you know, the field where you would finally get away from, you know, from a career as a central motivator, but you don't really at all. You find that your professors are mostly fighting each other for kind of prominence within their department and field. So yeah, okay. So lots of disillusionment, but you know, on the other hand, I think education is probably the best thing I did. And of course, particularly the part I chose, the early part, I had no choice. But I think choosing to go on for somebody from a poor background is something that can really broaden your horizons if you get the opportunity. So we want to kind of present these two different sides of both being a student and then being a lecturer. So basically, to go straight into it after that kind of intro, Bobby, so we're here to talk about art school and uni, and you're actually at uni. So we'll probably go into that a bit later because you're doing a master's remotely at St. Martin's. It's a remote degree. So anyway, before we get onto that, was your BA worth it? What did you study? Wasn't it film?
It was. At that point, I mean, I hadn't really even learned how to rebel. So, you know, for me, I think like going to uni actually felt like more of a rebellion than not, because my friends didn't, you know, none of my friends went to university. Maybe one or two went to kind of sports universities, but it wasn't really like the kind of done thing. My older sister went. So, yeah, I mean, it felt like a good way of getting away. Was it worth it? Yeah, definitely. I mean, I learned a lot about myself, and I discovered about art there. And what was it like back then? It was pretty relaxed, to be honest, and it was quite easy. I mean, 3 years seemed to pass pretty quickly. It wasn't cheap. Accommodation was quite expensive already. I mean, rent costs, but I worked as a waiter, and I'd saved up a bit of money because I'd been working the years before. And yeah, I was lucky enough that my parents did help me out a bit as well. And yeah, with a £9,000 student loan, you know, I was able to have a good time. What about you?
The student Where loan did you... back then. I did my first degree in 98 to 2001. So it's going back quite some time, and they just introduced tuition fees. It was a Conservative government policy, but Labour pledged to carry it on. They said that they would, I think it was basically keep on introducing the fees that were already being introduced. So, you know, while being a Tory policy, it was Labour, I think, that actually fully brought it in. Correct me if I'm wrong, or somebody can correct me in the comments maybe, but there were tuition fees. They were very low. I mean, compared to now, I think they were like £1,000 a year or something. And I think from my second year, they came in. And I think I didn't pay any. I actually got, I got an exemption because my parents were on low income. And effectively, it was only my dad's income being taken into account, I think, because I was living with him. So I had no fees, and I had a student loan, a full student loan. I think the student loan was means tested. So you got a full loan if you had really no money, if you could prove you needed it, maybe. Then a lot of my friends didn't have loans. Their parents paid their tuition, and they basically got money from their parents, like stipends. So that was like the real difference within our year group. There was the ones that were there, they had the loans, and the ones whose parents just gave them money. And then you think, well, probably they had similar amounts of money then, but, you know, because the parents aren't going to give them like thousands a month. But I remember the loans drying up pretty quickly. So you get your loans. One thing, of course, is you get your loans each semester, whereas I think the people with parents giving them money would have had like amounts trickled through that they could live on. So the ones with the student loans used to go down the student bar and other bars, because I was in Farnham, where there's a university College of the Central Arts now, but it was the Surrey Institute of Art and Design. And my first degree was in actually in fine art with a kind of strong theory element. And we used to just, there was like 20 to 30 pubs in a very small town, and we just used to go down to pubs. If you got a loan, you probably spent it pretty quick because you weren't having it micromanaged by your parents, and you'd normally run out of money pretty quick and then search for a job. I mean, that's not a position you could get in. So much of your parents were giving you money. Even if you did spend it, you'd probably have to cut a deal with your parents, maybe grovel to them and tell them, sorry, you'd spent your money too fast. I mean, that was something that certainly distinguished those categories of people, or effectively social classes. And maybe this is because, you know, when people talk about social class today, sociologically, they often talk about different attitudes towards money and and basically the middle class being hoarders and investors, and the working class being spenders. You know, the idea is that people who have no money, who get it, suddenly spend it very quickly. And it's, you know, it's a thing of living for the moment, or what you call instant gratification versus deferred gratification. Of course, these are kind of reductive as ways of talking about people. But I think it does stand to reason that if you come from a background with very little money and you end up, you know, with freedom at university, away from your parents for the first time, living with other people, you know, also maybe in their late teens, early 20s, then you will go a bit wild with your, with the most money you've ever seen in your account. So there was that kind of struggle to manage your money. But also, you know, a thing of really partying a lot, which you probably did more, frankly, if you were from a working class background. I did notice that, really. Although the middle class kids did try and keep up, and they enjoyed it. And us few kind of really quite poor kids were kind of known as the life and soul of the party, which is an interesting distinction. But anyway, I mean, so that happens at university. I mean, I've got mixed feelings about that, because back in the late 90s, certainly, you would go to uni and party really a lot. And I suppose if you were, you know, you were feeling out of place, or you're trying to find your place in the world, you might drink really a lot. Some people were doing a lot of drugs. I must say I wasn't really. At that point, I gave up smoking pot very young. But isn't uni a bit like a rite of passage for a generation that hasn't got any other rite of passage, i.e. in Western countries? You know, for that is to say, for young people, you know, the young generation in Western countries who don't have another rite of passage, you know, as other cultures might have. I don't know what it would be. I'm not an anthropologist, but you know, that this whole thing of like ship them off to uni is a way of getting them out of the house and of giving them a kind of short, sharp shock, to use an expression usually applied to prison. But, you know, jolting them into growing up fast and dealing with their own shit. But also, you know, channeling a lot of young kind of angst and desire to get on in the world into something, because there just isn't a place for that 50% of the population going to uni, which was the aim of Labour, which is what it became. It's probably dropped now. And then you kind of think, well, does everyone need to be in uni? Was it a place for everyone? Or, you know, I think it was a good place for me, but if they're going to suddenly throw everyone there and the main attraction is a student bar, which is the case in small towns, I don't think it's such a big problem in London for people who studied there. But you probably also need better facilities for kind of counselling people about alcohol and drugs and things. So that was one feeling I had at the time. But I think it's very much of that generation. I don't know that kids are doing that now, because I think Generation Z are apparently just drinking much less. And the students I had and doing less drugs, and the students I had in Rome and Italy, who were often American students, because I was in two American universities teaching, they certainly weren't getting off their heads as much as we had been. So that's an interesting difference. Anyway, so that was what my uni days were like, actually. But what did you find, that there was this strong tendency towards partying, maybe more amongst poorer people as well?
Yeah, for sure. I must say that, like, my parents weren't, I wouldn't say that my family was poor, certainly not at that particular time where I was 19 years old, and I had money in my pocket because I'd been working for a year, staying at my parents', you know, as an 18 year old, not paying rent. So I had a few grand in my pocket. But what I think is quite interesting is, well, all from my experience was like going there, arriving, and basically bringing like working class culture, you know, straight from home to the sort of university campus. And that meant like hardcore partying and drinking. And that just continued for 3 years. And I think, like, you know, I didn't have any idea really about Oxford or Cambridge or what was a good university, what was a bad one. It was more like, okay, you know, these are my A levels, where can I go? And it was just like, you know, one of my friends went to that kind of city, but it was a very like random place. I could have ended up anywhere, it felt like.
Well, yeah, that was the kind of way we did it back then. There was the old UCAS system. I don't know if it's still called that. Actually, I don't know if it actually stood for art colleges back then either. I'm not sure. That was certainly the system if you were doing humanities degree or science degree, that you'd apply, given your kind of six choices for uni, and there were like two of your top choices and there were the other ones or something like that. And the unis would either get back to you or not. You would do interviews and then you'd get your A-level results and then you'd go to uni based on that. But art college was different. You would do a foundation course, which is basically like an art course, a very broad art course upon which you did design, a bit of sculpture, maybe some film, photography, painting, and you would choose kind of your direction and then you would apply to art college, so to speak, or art uni. But you did feel a bit like you were being shunted off, like, you know, this is the way you would go, this is the path you would take, and you would end up at a uni somewhere and you would kind of say, I'd like to go to Chelsea in London, Cardiff in Wales, and I'll stick on the Surrey Institute. And then somehow you end up maybe your third choice. So I think I just thought this kind of looks nice and just stuck with it because I got an offer early on after doing an interview, but did feel like you were randomly ending up in a, you know, far flung parts of the country, or what felt like that for a lot of people.
Yeah, I went down to Southampton. It was very random. And the year before, I was going to go to Aberystwyth, and my dad was very keen to get me out of the house. He was like, just go. And I was like, no, I want to like work for a year and, you know, find out what I want to do. And he was just like, no, just go. Really wanted to kind of get me out. And
yeah,
you know, as far away as possible in a way. I don't know whether that was like projection, maybe like what he wanted to do, or he didn't have that chance.
Yeah, there is that feeling a bit that I don't know what English families would do with their kids if they just stayed at home at 18. And presumably aren't enough jobs for that portion of the population immediately after they finish school or A-levels. Or whatever, so as they finish, you know, when they get to 18 or so. But yeah, it does feel like people are like, well, you know, you're 18, get out, go to uni. But I think it's quite good. But this is specific to Britain, really, I think. Other countries don't do it quite the same. In Italy, they often end up going to uni in their same town and they stay at home and they do modules over years because, you know, to do a degree now, you need a certain amount of credits. You build up by doing subsequent modules. But you tend to do them in blocks, you know, very, very kind of predefined, you know, blocks over a period of 3 years, then that's your degree. And anyone who falls outside that ends up retaking a portion of their degree is kind of unusual. But in Italy, people just keep retaking and retaking and then deferring and retaking. And then they're not doing their degrees in like 7 years or something. Not all of them, but, you know, it happens in the Italian unis. I noted it, and they do often stay in their own city, not all of them either, but it's often the case. So, I mean, it's a very cultural thing, actually. Also, the states people move around, it seems. So it seems to be a quite Anglo-American system. And in Finland, where I am now, I think it depends. But maybe there's not such a race to get out of home. That says something about Britain, really, and America. I think it's an equal thing. It's like the parents want you to go, but also you want to get the hell out as well in Britain. Does seem very much to be the case. So, I think it was overall a valuable experience, and I think it probably still is for people. I don't follow what happens with art students much now, apart from on masters, because I have done some visiting lecturing on master's degrees, not on BA, but I have taught BA students who are humanities students. So making this broadly about culture, I suppose the thing that stands out today, although I was actually in Italy teaching, I have done some teaching for an Estonian uni and a couple of Finnish ones recently. But thinking mostly about my Italian experience, one of the things that stands out is the tuition fees. And there were fees where I was teaching, although there aren't fees really in Italy. There's just some kind of very minor admin fees. But because I was teaching in two private American universities, there were fees of $20,000 or so a year. which isn't a huge amount for an American uni. I guess it's around middling. But it's actually more than in Britain. But, you know, of course, people go there who have the money to go there, or there are scholarships to these particular two unis, John Cabot and the American University of Rome, and many unis like them in Italy because they have many private unis there and departments of unis that are in America that have their kind of study abroad buildings in Italy. But I did get a feel for the situation with fees and how that affects the student teacher relationship and how it affects the students. Although with the students, I must say they were just generally from backgrounds where the parents could afford it, obviously. In Britain, the situation is a bit different because suddenly the fees are just there. But there are grants for people from really low income backgrounds, but suddenly like a whole swathe of middle income families have to find this. Again, 9,000, 6,000 to 9,000 a year. And yeah, that changes things a lot because it's going to put a lot of pressure on the families, on the students themselves, who may have to contribute income, who may have to get jobs to get by more. And it changes the relationship with between the student and teacher and then what people might want out of uni. So it goes back a bit to this this thing of, you know, the art world. Well, the art world being very much about money and therefore unis being about money, or rather, maybe I've got that kind of upside down. The world's about money, therefore the art world is also about money, and unis, you know, art unis are about, you know, churning out students who may go on to get good galleries. I don't know if it's a gallery system in part molded by the academic system or vice versa. I think they're kind of working in cahoots. I think there's a certain amount of galleries tailoring the way they work to the output of unis, in the sense that unis have these degree courses that produce final shows at certain points of year of the year. So you'll have galleries scouring and collectors scouring places like the Royal College and St. Martin's, looking at their MA shows to see, you know, who's coming through, what students might be worth buying up. But you also have the unis maybe pandering to what the galleries might want, or, you know, having that in mind a little bit. I mean, is that something you find from people you know who've been studying? Because you know a lot of artists that have come through that system and you're studying now yourself.
I think there's still a lot of academics in art school which are anti the commodification of art, which I guess is like a healthy thing. But yeah, I mean, that's my particular experience, but I don't know. I mean, like the Royal College and the Royal Academy in London, they seem to be like the places to go in order to get a career somehow. That's the kind of like the subliminal kind of message. And I guess the Royal Academy, you know, has historically been a place like that. And that's where, you know, people like David Hockney went, and, you know, dozens more kind of well-known artists. I mean, and that was obviously like an era where there was tiny, the art world was absolutely tiny, and it's grown exponentially, you know, since then. But yeah, the Royal College, I mean, I think that it's this American kind of Anglo culture. And Hunter College in New York, I know, has like got that kind of had that reputation for basically, you know, connecting. I mean, it's very well located close to like the commercial galleries in New York City. So I think that, you know, there was a culture going on there where some artists were being primed for that kind of environment. But obviously, you know, the art has to be of a certain standard, and probably they were more looking for, you know, painters than other artists. But I think 10 years ago I used to think like, yeah, well, that looks like quite a sensible route, you know, to kind of getting on as an artist. But as the 10 years have gone on and I've seen kind of what happened to some of those artists, it's also a bit, I don't think it's not such a great thing. I mean, also, what in my personal experience, you know, it's like you don't really want to be relying upon like earning money from your artwork. Because if you do, you can get trapped in a kind of system and, you know, you just won't have any other kind of ways of maybe, you know, making money easily. So, I think like there's some definite kind of dangers there to that kind of that system about, you know, artists going to university and then getting picked up straight away by galleries.
Yeah, I mean, it does make people perhaps cynical very young. I mean, if the feeling going into art college is one of, you know, hey, I'm going to express myself, I'm going to be to some degree free, I'm going to be doing what I want and creating what I want. You know, I think it's a very big responsibility of tutors to kind of, you know, give shape to that and aid that, even if they know that, you know, the world doesn't quite work that way. I think you're basically in a position of dashing dreams if you take that and you're kind of like, you know, you're trying to push people away from, you know, Van Gogh or whatever and into Jeff Koons or whatever, you know, but not because you're saying Van Gogh's no good, you know, but because you're kind of like trying to bring them into the real world and you're conscious of maybe criteria in the grading, you know, people having to pay attention to contemporary art and what's happening. I mean, of course, a lot of students will go there fully understanding who Jeff Koons is and Damien Hirst and what have you. But, you know, there's still, you know, a certain pressure to leave aside the idea of, I actually wrote about this in my last book called And the Left Learn to Meme, which is about the direction that online culture should take, but actually begins talking about the art world and particularly art schools. So basically how the art schools lead people into a very financially driven vision. I think the thing is, it's like if freedom doesn't lie in art, where does it lie? And so if you're young and you're like, okay, everything sucks, but art gives me that freedom, and then, you know, you have this kind of what I called in the book, which is what I was getting into, this kind of spiritual revolutionary mindset. So, you know, you're all into Nietzsche and Buddhism and Vladimir Lenin, you know, it's a bit confused. It's a kind of hodgepodge of different historical figures with Van Gogh thrown in as well. And you know, hopefully some women figures there, sorry, as well. But, you know, it's a romantic vision. And the job of the uni is to push you down what I call in the book a materialist conservative path. So you have these two different kind of paths, a spiritual revolutionary path, which is kind of an archetype in the mind, you know, of, you know, your free thinking person who defies the odds and hopefully does something heroic, which is what everyone kind of wants to be when they're young. And then you have this other materialist conservative path, which is like the path that is most practicable, the one that, you know, you might gain from through steady incremental progressions and through understandings of things like the market. And, you know, I think it's a hell of a thing to push somebody from the one, which is what comes to you naturally as a young person, into the other, which is basically the conservative path that you maybe have to find yourself in by the time you're 60 or something, or, you know, somewhere between teenager and retirement. Yeah, you need to have made that progression at least to have some financial stability. But pushing that on people, you know, as the option when they're so impressionable, I think is quite cynical. So I think, you know, unis have a lot to answer to in that respect. I think what's worst about it is that to really prosper in uni, as in to get the top grades, because that's what it's really all about, you know, you pay that money to get the accreditation, you do need to have, you know, some strong awareness of this financial path, you know, of the gallery system, etc. So I think that's the thing that really kind of sucks, that you're kind of saying, well, you can do what you want, but if you want to get the grade, if you want to make this 9,000 a year worth it, or 6,000 or whatever people pay, then you need to fit the requirements of the financial sector, or art as an armature of the financial sector. So I think it is a bit odd, because, you know, if you think about what art actually is, I mean, there's so many interpretations and variations, but there are very valid lives to be lived where you can make art and not at all fit into the vision being pushed by the main unis, which you mentioned. So, yeah, because I think also if you teach at some of these unis that are known for churning out students that get taken up by galleries, and it used to be the thing of like Charles Saatchi might pick you up at your degree show in the Royal College or a master's. I don't know if people really say that anymore, if they change, you know, that cliche has changed into something else. But, you know, you go there and the kids are really kind of cocksure themselves. And, you know, if you got into your MA at, you know, an elite institution, you're kind of there already. You're kind of waiting to be picked up by the gallerist. So if you go there as a kind of employed expert, which I guess is what you are if you're asked to go and teach there, who's already kind of gone through the education system maybe, or you have some reputation in the art world, then the people you're talking to very much like, you know, you're going to have to impress me. That's their attitude, you know. Yeah, you're here, you're teaching me, but what do you know? Because I think the feeling of anyone on those masters is that they are a peer, you know, P-E-E-R, they are an equal of everyone else in the art world. That's the kind of, it's a little bit of misconception that probably annoys a lot of the teachers in those institutions as well, actually. In fact, I know it does annoy some of them. But I think, you know, you're charging them 9,000, but then you're charging foreign master students, was it 20,000? Are you going to say to them, well, here, you know, you have a place on the course, you have a little studio space, but you're basically dirt, and we're going to, like, you know, we're going to bring you up and make you into real artists, you know, and that's going to involve some revolutionary turmoil, or some spiritual turmoil rather. I don't know what revolutionary turmoil is. Spiritual, you know, they're not going to do that. They're going to be more like transactional. You're my client. What do you want? You know, what can I give you? And not client, maybe colleague. You know, you're my colleague. There's that kind of relation there, that if someone's paying 20,000, you're going to basically give them everything and say, yeah, you know, you're a peer in the art world. Our job here is to, you know, open up our contacts to you, basically open up our contact sheet, because you're worth it. And that's all. There's something incredibly weird about that whole setup. I don't know if you see that at all.
Yeah, but I think what you're saying, definitely, you know, in some instances, and it could be true, and maybe, like, I think we both know a few artists that they have been picked up, you know, before maybe their MFA. But yeah, I mean, it is the exception. I mean, I think there's only maybe one or two maximum every year. And the three that I can kind of think of that really got picked up very, very fast, and obviously, you know, had huge successes, Helen Martin. I think she went to Central St. Martin's, in fact. And she, you know, got picked up by Sadie Coles, won, you know, two awards. I think she won a Turner Prize, didn't she? And she won another big award, you know, within a few years. So that was when, I would say, within like 5 years of graduating, she had won those awards. But right away, she was picked up by a blue chip gallery, Sadie Coles. And then you've got Eddie Peake. That was the Royal Academy. He was a white cube, you know, right away. So these are, and then there's Oscar Murillo.
People who are picked up and end up selling in the hundreds of thousands. No, but I mean, there's a whole lot of variations between not being picked up by anybody and being picked up by, you know, really big galleries. You know, there's a whole lot of variations in between. And I think people who go on to degrees at these elite art units, so let's just say, basically, you know, for example, the Royal College, St. Martin's, Goldsmiths, who do their masters there, they hope to kind of end up somewhere on the spectrum of artists that are picked up or who benefit through connections. So you might not get picked up by a gallery, but then you've been at a Royal College, so then you have that on your CV, and people say, oh, Royal College. So then they might put you in the group show in the gallery, and then also you may have been on the degree with somebody who has become huge. So I mean, I don't mean to contradict what you're saying. I think you're right. They're not all picked up by any means, and maybe that dream is exaggerated, and maybe what can be done for people is exaggerated. But there's an expectation that going to these elite institutions will do something for your profile as an artist, and it won't have much to do with your art itself.
Yeah, I think like with these, I think there's a thing though to think about is a bit like, you know, if the artist has, I mean, first of all, like obviously they need to have at least some ounce of talent that's recognizable by someone, right? And you know, like going to a good college is like a way of for people to verify that. But then the second thing is like ambition and how big, you know, the ambition of that particular artist is. Now, if they are really ambitious, even when they're young, even if they're 16 or 20, you know, at some point they're gonna realize, if they're smart, they're gonna realize that, you know, one popular way to get to, you know, the position where you're gonna win like the Turner Prize in the UK, which is probably the most prestigious award, or you know what, or be with like the best gallery and you know get critics and you know museums to look at your work, museum curators, then it would be like to basically make good work, but then also go to the right art school and then show with like the right gallery. I think what is like, you know, more maybe dangerous for me, that's like the world is very capitalist. It's certainly like the western side, and like I think you said it earlier on, but you know, it's like the world is like that and we kind of have to fit in somehow to that. But then yes, secondly, I mean, like there are definitely like people at art school that make work which is not so easily commodifiable or perhaps fashionable at the time. And if you finish your Royal Academy or your Royal College, I mean, that's one of the great things about going to art college, is that you can actually make your work and you do have the studio space. You might have to share it. It might not be very nice, but you actually have that opportunity to kind of work and reflect and research. But then after art school, you've got to, you know, where are you going to put that work? How are you going to make it now? You know, I mean, you've got the internet and many artists are working like that on their computers. But if, you know, a gallery at best, if it's like a modest sized gallery, maybe a gallerist like the same generation as you, maybe, you know, you're going to get a few sales, and that's more like what my experience has been, which, you know, can cover some basic things that maybe you need to make your work such. And I wouldn't like bet against that being better, you know, that you're going to get more money than that for a part-time job, you know, if you had like a part-time low, you know, minimum wage job. But at least you have some studio, maybe some studio space, sometimes some materials.
Yeah, that was certainly a benefit when I did my art degree. And I think the studio was a great hangout place. And I think in a way, the partying I was speaking about was an extension of the learning. And in actual fact, I think that bars are often a learning environment for particularly people from poorer backgrounds who may be, you know, because if basically a lot of the people on your course are from private schools, they may actually even have been schooled in how to speak, how to present, etc. So in group discussions in class, maybe you have a situation where, you know, there are some people who are able to like wax lyrical like Shakespeare, or rather like one of his performers. And there's a number of people who don't feel at all comfortable about public presentation or talking up in groups, you know, so you'll find that they don't maybe relate to class very well, to being in class, you know, to being in school. And also they might fear authority. So even the one-to-one tutorials might not go down too well, but then they get talking in the bars, you know, about the subjects they were going over in the lectures, but maybe just about other stuff. Maybe they've been reading some Marx, they've been reading some Nietzsche, they want to talk about the news. That, you know, there's a whole education that goes on there, and that's not just at unis, that's in bars all over the country. When that culture existed, that's much less the case now because of the social media and smartphones and people interacting differently, but then even less now because of obviously the COVID and people not going to bars just closing down because of gentrification, and because it not being part of the culture anymore. So I think by the end of COVID, you know, with that added in, this is really going to be less and less a thing. But
yeah, plus the expense of alcohol as well.
Yeah, yeah, and it being a bit taboo these days more. Like apparently, younger generations aren't into it as much, so maybe that's happening less. But then there are online channels where people are talking about, you know, their reading and politics and stuff. So maybe it balances out. But certainly that was the case then. So, you know, between the studio experience, you know, some useful tutors. I certainly had useful professors and good professors in my time. You know, between that, the studio and bars and occasional useful lectures. But I don't learn from lectures because I have a terrible attention span. So I'm not the best example. But, you know, those things kind of thrown in, I think it can certainly be a good thing. But then you have to factor in the cost and that you're being pushed down a very capitalist mindset. And you know, of course, unis are, well, I mean, the whole thing about fee paying, you know, suggests unis are very much of the capitalist mindset. But also I think you have to imagine that over time, whatever's getting taught in unions probably isn't a threat to the system. So you've got some Marx there, you've got some Frankfurt School stuff. Okay, on paper, this is kind of challenging towards capitalist values, but, you know, really it doesn't do much. You know, I think if you're poring over the details of Marx, even more so the Frankfurt School, you're probably not doing much to challenge the system. And unions are full of texts that have been part of the canon of text for decades, for centuries. I think you've got to ask what's not on the canon sometimes, because maybe that's more useful in terms of challenging the way things work politically in any given country. And then that gets onto alternative education systems, which we don't really have time to go into this time. It should be another episode one time. But you do get actually moments in which the art world is very preoccupied with curatorial aspects of education, or, you know, how education can be used curatorially and also by artists. And you get alternative schools and things, and this sometimes crosses over with alternative education models working within occupied spaces and you know, grassroots political movements. So, you know, there are all these possibilities. You can also get, you know, you can get education outside unis, and you can, I mean, you can get one online as well now. So, you know, there are all these possibilities. I mean, you do need your degree. Often you need that piece of paper to get a job. But then how often does anyone actually need that piece of paper to get a job in the art world? That's an interesting one. I suppose the unions get you picked up by a gallery. That's one thing. But I don't actually know. Oh, no, I'm wrong. I'm wrong because, of course, every time I've taught in a uni, it's been because I've studied and got qualifications in unions before. So, yeah, okay, for an academic job, you will want that certificate. So, you know, that is, that's it, you know. We're kind of stuck there. I think one has to get a degree and also educate themselves outside the system.
Yeah, I think the other thing to think about is like, okay, so what, I mean, say if someone can't afford to go to university, Mike, and they don't, you know, they, or, you know, what could they do? What's like an alternative strategy? Because the one thing that I found about going to university is that I learned, it kind of stimulated me to kind of find out more stuff. And I'm just not sure if I would have had like the links to that stuff, you know, if I would have been confronted and inspired to kind of explore more, even more like, you know, further left-wing ideas and even, you know, anarchistic ideas or anarchistic ways of living, or, and sort of just rejecting work. I mean, at one point I started to kind of reject, you know, being part of society, I felt. So, you know, what can you do now? I mean, with the internet and without paying, what? I mean, free schools. You were a part of a free school, weren't you? At one point, weren't you? Didn't you give some lectures?
Have I given lectures at free schools? Well, I mean, there was a whole network of online schools. I mean, I did actually. I ran a project called Towards a Free Education, and it was run in Italy, in Rome. I for a year was in residence with a foundation called NOMAS Foundation, and basically the idea was to research setting up a free school which would kind of supplant the uni system and give free education through a network of art institutions. And it culminated in its first phase in a conference in the Macro Museum in Rome. And we had Mark Fisher speak about alternative education systems. And that's somewhere online. In fact, if you go on to Nero magazine on YouTube, or maybe if you Google Nero Mark Fisher on YouTube, you would find this talk that Fisher gave at this conference. I managed or curated. And there were a few other people like David Blacker, who's written on alternative education systems. Adelita Husni Bey, who represented Italy at the Venice Biennale a few years ago. And there were other people, there were a few interesting people there. And the idea of that project was to start some syllabi or syllabuses and run them online, and there would be a free accreditation system. So the real thing was like getting around the issue of accreditation. So people need this certificate to get these jobs, as I just was saying. And then I kind of ended saying one does need a degree. Then you have to educate yourself outside the uni system as well. But I didn't mean that was an ideal situation. You were quite right to say, you know, what does one do if they're poor? So the idea was to like offer a free system where you could get that accreditation without paying for it. So how did we give that certificate outside the uni system? You'd need a network of institutions and individuals that had got some kind of accreditation previously at universities to agree to grade the work of people responding to these online modules. I mean, the whole thing was plausible and people were into it, but it didn't take off. I then took the project to the Venice Biennale and we did a few performances around it in 2013. But I think I just got distracted by other things. But then what became apparent was that to get this thing to work at any level, so people recognize the accreditation that we gave, you would kind of need the universities on board. And then the art world is so linked in with universities that no one really has an interest in breaking up the monopoly of the universities. I don't think there are many big art institutions that would be on board with that. It works more of a symbolic level. In terms of like actually teaching stuff, there's never been more free options, including obviously BreadTube and LeftTube, which are basically a similar thing, but you know, left-wing things on YouTube. But YouTube as a whole, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, like the whole system's been like, you know, the internet's obviously disrupted other industries, like music and cinema. But I mean, education is really going to start to be the next big hitter now, isn't it? I mean, you can see, I mean, there's lots of these kind of masterclass kind of things that you can do now online. And, you know, the internet is changing the game, but we might have to leave that to another time, Mike, because it's a huge subject.
Well, it's true that the internet can lead something like that, but it's still going to be, I mean, I think the thing is, yeah, people do learn off BreadTube and LeftTube. They learn, they get encouraged to read Marx and Adorno and stuff. Fisher obviously is a big one that's blown up a lot online. Even memes can get people kind of enticed into reading people. It's how everyone organizes that, it's one, how one uses that, what you learn usefully to get you a job. I don't know if you can, but I suppose, you know, it kind of like inspire people creatively, and that might kind of lead them to make stuff that then helps them get a job or make money by selling the artwork that is inspired by online dialogue. But yeah, I think in terms of like free education systems teaching people stuff that might lead to new political forms or to people becoming more left-wing or more right-wing or whatever, that's definitely happening. And that is very good for the working classes. I mean, in a sense, if it makes people more left wing, it would be good. I don't buy that it's a good thing if it makes them more right wing, and that is happening a lot. But you're still left with how does this actually equip you for life in a financial sense? And that is a big problem because we're in a capitalist society. Well, any society, you're going to need material stuff. So, I mean, uni unfortunately remains the main way of, you know, learning formally and getting qualifications to help you get ahead. So, but I mean, I would say, I mean, go to uni. Also, I mean, if you can teach and you fancy teaching, teaching's a great thing. I've really enjoyed it. And you do feel like you're passing knowledge on to the kids. You do feel a bit like it is relied upon that your work at maybe not the optimum rate recompense, because you get into this strange kind of thing of feeling, how can you say, not an affinity sounds wrong, but you feel you're in a position of pastoral care, that you have younger people that are reliant on you for knowledge, but sometimes they need support. You know, they might tell you their problems or something. And this becomes like, you want to do it, but it's also extra energy you're expending. I think the unions rely on that. They know that you, as a kind of elder of your students, you are kind of inspired to put in extra hours, and they're not going to be credited, you know. So there's a goodwill, natural intrinsic goodwill of humans, and let's say mostly left-leaning humans in humanities and arts subjects, is leverage for profit of people who are maybe more unscrupulous. So that's a little problem. But, you know, I think basically we're all exploited in the capitalist system. So I think teaching is one of the best ways to be exploited. And you do get to pass on a kind of a vision. I won't say left-wing vision, because we're not supposed to like indoctrinate people, but you get to pass on the right kind of vision. So yeah, that's all good. So, I mean, unions are good, but there's a heck of a lot of work needs doing to make them better. Any final thoughts on that, Bobby?
I would just say, like, one other thing is that, like, there is also, like, the jobs market within the university and certain contacts within the university. And, you know, I started my MA in October, and by January, you know, I'd signed a contract for, like, a part-time job where, you know, I do get paid to have online dialogue with people. You know, I get to interview people online. But, you know, at the same time, I mean, it's a zero contract hours job, and it's not very well paid. So, you know, there are, you know, like, I just mean, like, it might not be necessarily contact with the art world, but it can also be contact with an institution. And there are all types of jobs within an institution, such as, you know, technical jobs. So, you know, there is that also. Contradictory kind of place. The university is like a contradictory place, because, you know, they you know, one does encounter a lot of, like, of the left wing, the more left wing kind of postmodernist philosophers, but yet the institution also has to operate in that sort of capitalist environment. So the student fees are high. I believe that, like, course leaders get paid probably quite well, but, you know, people that are doing visiting lectures in the UK, I think, are getting, like, no more than, you know, they're not really getting great money, are they? I don't know. What are the current rates? Like 200?
200 for a standalone lecture, maybe, if your expertise is sought out specifically, and if you're giving maybe a lecture to an auditorium. But, I mean, individual kind of lectures as part of a course, you're probably getting 20 an hour or so, from 20, 25 in Britain, which surprised me, because I've seen it, if you're visiting at least in other countries like Finland and Italy. In Italy, it was a particular case because I was in two private unis, but you're talking 80, 90 in...
Is this visiting lecturing, by the way? Is this as a sort of a PhD graduate who's visiting lecturing?
To be fair, sometimes I've been visiting in Finland, and then you're talking like 70, 80, I think. I don't remember the exact amount per hour. But in Italy, like, as a semester teacher, contracted by semester, So you would know that you would do the whole semester, but you might not come back the next semester. So, you know, you only have that much stability of a few months knowing that you're employed still. That actually was high. It was like 80, 90 euros an hour, but the tax rate is obscene. So you end up with half of that. And then you have to account for another hour for every hour taught for prep and for communication with students. I mean, the prep, once you know a course, is nothing. I mean, everyone knows once you've done a course, like, once you already know the course, but you may have to change things that are topical. So if you're teaching something and you were going to refer to a news story last week, the next semester you do it, you might want to change the news story. So there's this small amount of prep, but it's not much. But it's more that students are going to need your attention. Like, they may want you to see their homework before they hand it in. They may want to talk about something else. Students are incredibly needy now, particularly with paying, you know, a large amount of fees. You know, they want to ask as much questions, maybe a bit needier, because the relationship with authority is a bit different to when we were in uni. So they maybe feel more like on level to just tell you what's going on in their life, or just to point out that they don't understand something, like, you know, that they maybe years ago people would have shut up and tried to find out the information somewhere else. But that's not to say they should. You know, I think that it's great the students ask questions. It's not to say they should shut up. Well, I think in our generation, we tended to, like, you know, not be so forthcoming with questions. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff you have to put up with. So, I mean, for every hour of teaching, there's probably another hour. So if you're getting like 40 after tax, you're actually getting 20, you know, ultimately. But in unis in London, you're often getting 20, 25. And then you're getting, if you're actually like not coming in often, if you're like visiting, or you're only doing like one semester and you're maybe not coming back, you're not seeing yourself coming back, you're probably not going to get loads of those questions from students because they don't know you. But you are going to get a prep because it's going to be your first time. So you're probably going to lose half of it in prep, especially if you're trying to impress the uni, because you're fighting to come, for them to ask you back, which is the thing about temp jobs, of course, that you're struggling that bit more because you want to be asked back. So yeah, I think you probably lose half of it realistically. I think, you know, that's it. The pay in, you know, for part-time casual lecturing in unis in England is ridiculous. I mean, I would question the sense in doing it, frankly, rather than picking up bits of freelance work. You know, presumably if you're teaching in the uni, then you're capable of proofreading or film editing, or, you know, you're already doing some of this stuff. So yeah, but then that's not to say that other people shouldn't do it, but I'm just saying that it's pretty obscenely low. Yeah.
Is it correct to say that if you have a PhD, then that means that you can teach MA, and if you have an MA, then that means you can teach BA, and if you have a BA, that means that you can teach at A levels, because that's what, you know, I heard very recently from someone that works inside a university.
Put quite that way. I think there are instances in which people teach at the level they obtained. So they may have an MA and teach MA because they may have like a lot of experience, or, you know, they have some professional experience, which can be useful to students, and they might not even have the degree. But that's pretty rare. It's hard to say. I mean, it's not completely cut and dry like that, but yeah, I guess you're pretty much right. I mean, you want to be ahead of the student to some level. So I think most people who teach BAs have MAs, yeah. And then I think people who teach MAs have at least MAs, and often increasingly PhDs. But actually, it's increasingly the case that anyone in a uni will have an MA or PhD when it wasn't, or should I say, sorry, anyone in the uni will now have a PhD who's teaching. This is increasingly the case, which has become the new standard, just because there are more people going to uni and there's more BAs, MAs and PhDs across the board. I think that is the case. I mean, you do stand yourself in better stead to get a uni job, to get any kind of academic position now with a PhD, but it's asking people a lot now to do the whole lot, the BA, the MA, the PhD with the fees. Because when I did my MA, the fees had just come in. So I did it part-time. This is one thing worth considering, actually, people, is that part-time fees tend to be half full-time fees. So where your MA might be 1 year full-time, it would in that case be 2 years part-time, and you would pay half as much. So it might make it much more doable. And then, of course, you can work, you know, because you're not learning full-time, only part-time. And a PhD, this is really worth bearing in mind, that it tends to be 3 years full-time, something like 3 to 5 years full-time. But whilst it's around 5 to 7 part-time, you can finish it in 4 or even less than 4. So the thing is, you pay half as many fees for part-time, but you still, if they have lectures in your course, they tend to have lectures on PhDs now, you still get lectures. And you still get to see your tutor now and then. And that's the main part of a PhD, because you're basically just writing your thesis. But you could potentially, if you're working a lot on it, at home, so to speak, you know, or outside your formal meeting hours, you could potentially still get it put through in 4 years. You see what I mean? So many people who pay full time also get it done in 4 years or 3. So that's really worth bearing in mind if you're paying your fees for uni for a PhD, is to put in for part-time and MA. But I mean, when I did the MA, it was like 1,200. Maybe that was part-time, but it was all way less then. And sometimes I had a grant, sometimes not, but it was all way less. So I could say, yeah, okay, well, I felt like, being from a working class background, I didn't want to be deterred. I wanted to get those qualifications, because I thought I should be able to. I didn't want to be told I couldn't. But saying that to somebody, from my background now, I'm aware that it means something completely different, because you're talking about finding 9,000. Of course, you'll get help on your BA, I think, if you have low income parents with low income. But you won't get that help on your very easy on your master's or PhD, apart from applying for grants and things. There is a big book called something like the Book of Grants, literally, that's available in libraries. Like, you know, most town libraries will have it, and unis will have it, and it's just massive book of grants for humanities, for science subjects, for arts subjects, these charitable trusts and foundations and things that give money for people studying. So it's always worth going through that. I'm terrible, because I hate just doing stuff like that, because I always think it's, you know, it's a lot of work, and I'm lazy. I know people who do it and they get money. So always bear that in mind as well. Don't be deterred anyway. Find a way to do it if that's what you want. I know that it's not the only way, but it does give something. One final word on that is that some people are very down on PhDs for a couple of reasons. Well, I think partly because it's a bit elitist, the system. So, you know, people kind of look up to PhDs, and maybe they're not particularly much smarter than people with BAs or MAs. They just, you know, they spent longer in education. But I think, I think partly because I think there is that. It's like, people think, well, you know, you hang about long enough in the uni, you end up with a PhD. I kind of get it. And I get the thing that people are like, well, a lot of people just pay for their degrees. They get other people to write their essays and shit. That does happen. But, you know, that's not really the point, because if you actually do it and you do the work, you are going to probably get better at theorizing, rationalizing, if you're doing a fine art degree, like a practical degree, at contextualizing your work. I found, because I had this one professor called Alex Duttmann, he's German, he studies Frankfurt School a lot, and Heidegger, he's done some work on, and I believe Nietzsche. He's quite stern in a way. I mean, he's friendly enough and always helpful, but he'll just say to you, you know, I think that needs more work. I think what you've said there is basically what you'd expect from a BA student in their first semester. He'll just tell you straight out like that. He say, I think that, and then he'll say, I think where you've read Kant there, I think you'll find you got that wrong. It needs some more work. But it'd be like that. I think you found that wrong. You need some more work, kind of in a German way, but I can't really do German. But and then you would go, shit, okay, he's spoken. And then you go and work, and you'd know that you hadn't met the standard. You know, before that, I was in the art world, and people were like, yeah, I love your writing. Can you do a bit of writing for my show? Back then in London, it wasn't generally paid, and maybe tiny bits of money were coming my way. But they all loved it, you know, because I'd written on them anyway. And because they hadn't probably, you know, studied a lot of theory. But going on his PhD, this guy was saying to me, you know, you look at paragraph 6 of the second chapter, Nietzsche. I think that leaves something to be desired. I think you'll find you've misinterpreted eternal return or something. And then you're just like, okay. And the thing is, he didn't have to say much, because then you knew you had to read back through it, and then you were going to find something else, and you were going to deepen it and make it better. He didn't tell you, don't say that, say that. And that was something incredibly useful. And I think you'll find some useful PhD tutors like that, who'll turn you into more critical thinkers, and who won't like just tell you you're right all the time. That is a problem with friends and with peers in the art world, is they're going to tell you you're great. And at some point, you really don't want that. You want somebody making it difficult for you. So that is the benefit, where you won't get that anywhere else, frankly, if you're doing your own work. Of course, it's bullshit if people are paying other people to do their work. Those people exist, and they end up also in universities, and that's worrying. But if you're not one of them, then fuck it. You're going to be the one experiencing some kind of form of self-development academically, and in your thought. So I think that's just worth bearing in mind. If that experience could be found outside of uni, by all means, find that as well. But that's, you know, what one needs as a developing thinker or artist at some point. So, yeah, that's my last word. Next episode, we'll be back with more on being down and out in the art world, how to survive the art world, and fields of culture and theory. And by all means, get in touch. Tell us what works for you, what you want to hear more of, and we'll see you then. Thank you.